Welcome to episode 72 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and professor at the University of Georgia and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, family physician and associate professor at Rush University in Chicago.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. For you history nuts out there, there's been a lot that happened this week in history. In 1766, the British Parliament repealed the Evil Stamp Act. And on the heels of that, in 1789, the first Congress endorsed the U.S. Constitution.
Well, the latter one was probably a little more relevant to us, so good to know about the Stamp Act. And that was not John Hickner. That's Kate Rowland. She is an associate professor at Rush University. We've taught with Kate many times before. We love her work, and she's a great evidence-based family physician, and we're just delighted to have you with us, Kate. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, excited to be here.
All right. So in this podcast, we highlight patient-oriented evidence that matters or poems. If you want all of the poems, subscribe to Essential Evidence, where you get a poem daily, plus a great primary care reference with over 800 disease and symptom chapters and thousands of interactive decision support tools. You can check it out at EssentialEvidencePlus.com. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. You can get free CME credit from the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians. Just go to iafp.mclms.net to claim it. This week, we're going to discuss newer agents to treat diabetes, new medication for migraine prevention, and antidepressants for managing patients with back pain or DJD. And I'm going to kick it off with a little study on some of these newer agents for diabetes. It was in the BMJ. The first author was Palmer, and it was called sodium glucose cotransporter protein 2, SGLT2 inhibitors, and glucagon-like peptide GLP-1 receptor agonists for type 2 diabetes, systematic review and network meta-analysis of randomized trials. So this was, as I said, this was a well-done network meta-analysis of randomized trials that compared an SGLT2 inhibitor or a GLP-1 agonist with some other kind of treatment for type 2 diabetes. A network meta-analysis combines direct comparisons from individual studies with indirect comparisons. So the indirect comparison is if A is better than B and B is better than C, then they conclude that A is better than C. They identified an amazing 764 trials with over 400,000 patients. And that was enough that they are actually able to look at the results by the patient's baseline cardiovascular risk. The quality of the studies was generally good, and there was good homogeneity for most outcomes, meaning the studies generally found the same thing in the same direction. Both drug classes lowered all-cause mortality, cardiovascular mortality, non-fatal MI, and kidney failure. SGLT2 inhibitors were a little better at reducing hospital admission. GLP-1 receptor agonists were more likely to reduce non-fatal stroke. The absolute benefit, and this makes sense, the absolute benefit depended on the underlying cardiac risk. Patients at low risk had less benefit. They had less to gain, 2 to 5 fewer deaths per 1,000 patients treated over 5 years. On the other hand, for higher risk patients, and in fact, in the highest risk group, there were 24 to 48 fewer deaths per 1,000 patients over 5 years. And they actually provide a great calculator if you just go to the BMJ and find this article. Again, first author, Palmer, BMJ 2021, volume 372, M4573. You can find this really cool calculator that, where you select the patient, your patient's level of risk and the outcome you're concerned about, and they will tell you how many fewer or more events there are per 1,000 person year. So it's a really nice calculator. Bottom line, these newer drugs, SGLT2 inhibitors, the Flozins, and the GLP-1 agonists, which end in TIDE, reduce mortality and cardiovascular and renal outcomes more than placebo or other treatments. We should certainly be considering them in addition to metformin for most patients with type 2 diabetes, and particularly those who have higher cardiovascular risk. Kate, what do you think?
Yeah, I think this is something that we're seeing obviously more and more of, and I do wonder if this is going to make it, how it's going to make it into the next round of guidelines from our various diabetes guideline issuing bodies. Cost is obviously the biggest concern. When you're choosing a treatment just based on diabetes risk, but I think the cardiovascular outcomes are really going to start making a play before it's always just been whatever's available to the patient. And I think that this is really going to start to make a big difference.
Henry, what do you think?
First of all, the BMJ recently has been doing a lot of these meta-analyses where the online version is highly interactive, where you can actually tailor the output based on your needs. And that's really just a remarkable change in the last year or two. And so I think it's worth highlighting that this is a journal that seems to get it right. Second point is that, as Kate pointed out, that these new classes of medications are expensive, but the trade-off in terms of real-world clinical outcomes is really important. I want to just sort of push a little bit on metformin. It's been foundational for us for a number of years, but when you really look behind the covers a little bit to see is the emperor actually wearing any clothes, the data on metformin improving outcomes is actually pretty thin and weak. The UKPDS trial on a very small subset of patients who were obese, now that may constitute most of my former patients with type 2 diabetes. Nonetheless, that was the only subset of patients that had any improved outcomes. Oh, by the way, there have been at least three other trials that did not replicate that. And there are two Cochrane reviews, one done in 2020 that looked at metformin as monotherapy that did not find any conclusive evidence that metformin improved outcomes. And then in 2019, there was a Cochrane review of metformin in combination with other medications that they found something like 32 randomized trials and still could not find any conclusive data that metformin improved outcomes. Now, the fact that it's dirt cheap, in fact, some of the pharmacies in our area give the stuff away for free, makes it attractive, but I don't think that should necessarily drive a lot of our decision making.
Yeah, I think what we need are studies that directly compare metformin with some of these newer agents and get a sense of, you know, if there is a significant benefit. And I'm sure that the drug companies will do cost effectiveness analyses to show that $500 a month is cost saving because it prevents heart attacks and strokes. It may be. And certainly, I think we should be strongly considering these for our patients. Again, I wish the cost was a little lower, but this is probably the strongest evidence to date from a really well-done meta-analysis on these new agents. And it's pretty impressive. Time for the quiz. I'm going to do it this week, given Henry the week off. The ACG, American College of Gastroenterology, just released some new guidelines for the management of irritable bowel syndrome. Which of the following was recommended by the group? Routine colonoscopy to evaluate for inflammatory bowel disease, malignancy, and microscopic colitis. B, treatment with probiotics. C, routine use of serologic testing for celiac disease. D, use of fecal transplant for patients with persistent symptoms. And E, antispasmodic drugs. Stay tuned. Henry, you going to tell us about migraine?
Thank you. So the question asks, is rimegepant, or marketed under the trade name Nurtec, effective in the prevention of migraines? This was published by Krupp and colleagues in Lancet just within the last month. This was a randomized trial. Basically, everything was sponsored by the manufacturer of Nurtec. The researchers, the people who wrote it, were all basically on the payroll. And that doesn't necessarily invalidate the findings. It just means that any spin that there might be, you just need to be very careful about it. So they randomized adults who had at least 4, but no more than 18, migraine attacks every month over a previous 3-month period. They excluded patients who had already tried 2 classes of migraine preventive medications. So this was a pretty select group with refractory migraines, which kind of gets lost in some of the marketing. They did a 4-week run-in period where nobody got any treatment. They just completed diaries so that they could establish a baseline rate that they could then measure and tie the outcomes to individual patients. On average, during that four-week period, the patients in each group had about 10 days with headaches. And then they entered into this 12-week period where they received, in double-blind fashion, either a placebo or every other day rimegepant. And that was 75-milligram dose. At the end of that time, it turned out that the placebo-treated patients had 3.5 fewer headache days. Okay, that's not bad. Placebo worked pretty well. The rimegepant-treated patients had 4.3 fewer days, so a big whopping 0.8-day difference per month. But if you take the marker that most people would find to be more important, a 50% reduction in the frequency of headaches, and this is one that the International Headache Society actually promotes as a standard measure, it turns out that you end up with a pretty significant reduction where the rimegepant, the number needed to treat would be about 14 based on their analyzed data. But they played a little bit fast and loose. They didn't include everybody that they randomized. So I went back and I did my own little reanalysis and include those individuals that were randomized at the beginning. And the differences of 40% that had a reduction versus 46% would no longer be statistically significant. So in my interpretation of this, at best, rimegepant is marginally effective, but probably not much more effective than placebo. Oh, by the way, they kind of downplayed some of the toxicity in terms of hepatotoxicity. There was one patient in the active treatment group that had an ALT that was more than 10 times the upper limit of normal. And they said, well, that's not really related to the intervention because the patient took additional doses. But that's kind of real world. And so to me, that suggests that there's probably a very marginal safety issue in regards to this. So based on GoodRx.com information, taking it every other day is still $1,800 a month. At that rate, I would probably keep trying other agents before I would come to this one, including maybe even acupuncture or riboflavin. Mark.
Wow, Henry, thanks for telling us about this amazing new drug. I'm just, it's barely effective. It costs $1,800 a month and it's potentially toxic if patients don't quite adhere to the instructions. It's amazing. Yeah, thank God they've invented this one. Yeah, I would try a lot of other things first before I went to this one. And it is interesting. Thanks for doing that reanalysis. And that, you know, better reflects what we can expect in real world practice. And yeah, absolutely. Patients with painful conditions are often, you know, understandably quite desperate for relief. And it's not surprising that someone said, I'm just going to take it every day. If every other day is good, every day is going to be better. And just that led to this significant bump in their ALT. So yeah, not my favorite. Kate, you got any? Anything good to say about this drug?
Oh, I have. You left out the most important part, which is that it's currently being pitched by Khloe Kardashian.
I don't know who that is.
Yeah, that's probably why you left it out.
Well, I know who that is, but I didn't know she was pitching it. But yeah. Yes. Okay.
So that may you know help explain why anybody would take it. But the thing I do wonder about is tolerability, because, you know, valproate and, you know, topiramate, somewhat notoriously not very well tolerated. So even if they are, you know, more effective, you know, pretty high discontinuation rates due to tolerability. So if we're looking at a, you know, NNT of 14, there's going to be people are going to find that, you know, appealing in the, if the other option is, you know, is valproate or topiramate or even beta blockers, which a lot of times I think people find not that effective. I wonder a little bit about tolerability, even, you know, and again, you know, your reanalysis versus Khloe Kardashian on TV, that's a tough tough comparison.
I think I know who wins.
The other thing that I think is really interesting about this, and I don't love it, is if you go to the website for this medication, you can click through as a patient, you can click through to a video visit with a neurologist who will prescribe it for you. And I saw this for the first time on the website for this medication, but I've seen it since on other new drugs. So this is something that I think, you know, obviously primary care physicians want to be aware of, and other primary care clinicians, that now it's gone beyond direct, you know, to consumer marketing, straight to direct to consumer purchasing or prescribing, you know, and people may be able to access it without, you know, their physicians or clinicians even knowing. So that was this was the first drug that I remember seeing this straight on the website. But I've seen it other places as well.
Wow, that's new to me, and I obviously got to watch more TV. But that is crazy, and yeah, I've seen it for, you know, ED drugs and things like that, but for this kind of drug, and I bet the neurologist is going straight to Nurtec, right? Pretty sure. Okay, well, that's interesting. And Kate, it's your turn to tell us about antidepressants for back pain.
Sure. So this poem asked just that question, are antidepressants useful for back pain? And also looked at osteoarthritis pain from knee OA. So this was a study done, published in the BMJ by Ferriera and colleagues. The title was Efficacy and Safety of Antidepressants for the Treatment of Back Pain and Osteoarthritis. It was a systematic review and meta-analysis. So they looked specifically at randomized controlled trials. The researchers analyzed a total of 33 placebo-controlled studies, included about 5,300 participants with chronic low back pain with or without sciatica and knee pain due to OA. They did a regular systematic review, so they searched both the published and unpublished literature, databases including Cochrane Central, and clinical trial registries, so looking hard for any data that they could find. And then they evaluated the use of antidepressants for symptom relief. So usually it was pain, but also function. Again, low back pain, neck pain, sciatica, and knee OA. So what they found, SSRIs and SNRIs do not produce meaningful reduction in back pain. And for this study, it's important to note that the authors, as happens in many other studies, were using a 10-point change on a 0 to 100-point scale as a clinically meaningful difference. And this, again, it's common to define a clinically meaningful difference. And what has happened is that other studies have gone to patients and said, if we've got a 100-point scale, how much would that scale need to change for you to feel like you were actually better? And patients say 10 points, because if it's 2 points, that's not enough. I don't actually feel better if the scale only moves 2 points. So they use 10 points as a clinically meaningful difference. And that's important because in some of these cases, the researchers found a 2-point change or a 4-point change, which can be statistically significant in the before and after groups, but it's not clinically meaningful. So again, the patients wouldn't identify that as a big enough difference for them to actually say that they felt better or that their function improved. So the specific outcomes that they found in this study, sciatica may respond in the short term in the first 2 weeks to SNRIs, which included duloxetine, but the effect wasn't sustained in the 3 to 13 week timeframe. Tricyclics, which included nortriptyline and amitriptyline, may produce sustained pain reduction after a little bit of a slow onset. So they found larger effects at 3 to 12 months than they did at 3 to 13 weeks. And not unsurprisingly, didn't find much of an effect before 2 weeks. Knee pain associated with osteoarthritis, not meaningfully affected by SNRI treatments, again, including duloxetine, was the only treatment studied for that particular kind of pain. Disability may be slightly improved, so that may be a worthwhile outcome for sure. In general, for all of these studies, heterogeneity across the studies was low. Study quality tended to be low. The amount of evidence overall tended to be low. So again, they found 33 studies over all of these different outcomes, all of these different kinds of pain and conditions that they were studying. So not a large amount of evidence that they found. So again, bottom line, small, low-quality studies, TCAs may eventually produce modest pain reduction for people with sciatica. SSRIs and SNRIs do not provide meaningful benefit. No antidepressant has been shown to be effective for back pain or knee pain associated with OA. SNRIs may produce a small effect on disability. What do we do? It gives us our old standbys, NSAIDs, acetaminophen. Exercise therapy may improve pain and function, especially for back pain. We could offer capsaicin. Opioids are effective, probably not recommended. They, in fact, are no longer recommended due to the risk of adverse effects. So tough condition, tough to treat. Henry, do you have anything better to suggest?
better? No, we've talked about some of these same issues in the past that when you look at mechanical problems like back pain and degenerative joint disease and the like, we find the repeated theme that medications are generally disappointing. You might find specific individuals that might have more of a placebo effect, but generally that these are underwhelming. And as you pointed out, some things might be useful. We've got a recent poem on exercise for back pain that we'll probably review in an upcoming episode. And that's kind of an interesting, lengthy discussion. But when you think about all of these other things, well, what else is left? Well, what about cannabinoids? You've done some talks on cannabinoids.
I'm there with you. Maybe CBD oils, huh? Hey, I think we also had a study recently where physical therapy was more effective than steroid injections for knee osteoarthritis. And it's just hard to get, you know, weight loss helps with osteoarthritis. Weight-bearing exercise, walking, gradually building up that endurance, doing exercises specifically to strengthen the quads. You know, those are all things that have been shown to improve outcomes, but it's tough to stick to, it's tough to achieve. It's a challenging condition. Henry, any final thoughts on that?
Yeah, just one last point that Kate talked about, and I think it's worth just mentioning that it's a recurring theme that quite often we may see a statistically significant difference in things, but they may not necessarily be clinically important. And so be careful when you have drug reps or other people who are promoting a product saying that, you know, p-values are infinitely less than zero. It doesn't matter if it's not clinically meaningful.
Yeah, another way to look at that is if you see a study that had to be gigantic in order to find a difference between two groups, there might be a reason for it. And another way that they get at that clinically meaningful difference is to ask patients about their symptom in two ways. So, you know, your pain is, you know, 50 or 60 or 70, and then rate it from good, very good, excellent, or whatever in terms of the response. And what it takes to move from good to very good or very good to excellent is typically in that 10 to 15 point range to move you up to where you qualitatively feel significantly better. So good stuff, guys. And it's time for the quiz answer. And again, the ACG has new guidelines for irritable bowel. Which of the following was recommended? A, routine colonoscopy. B, probiotics. C, routine serologic testing for celiac disease. D, fecal transplant for persistent symptoms. And E, antispasmodic drugs. So the group actually recommends against routine colonoscopy, although obviously we should consider it selectively based on patient presentation and symptoms. Fecal transplant, while it's effective for recurrent C. diff, possibly for inflammatory bowel disease, there's very little evidence for its use with irritable bowel. While others have found some benefits to probiotics in other studies and meta-analyses, I'm guessing the manufacturers haven't given the ACG enough money. Kidding. I'm just kidding. I'm a kidder. Antispasmodics aren't recommended either. They do recommend super expensive and marginally effective drugs like linaclotide and lubiprostone. The correct answer is C, serologic testing for celiac disease using anti-endomycial antibodies or tissue transglutaminase antibodies, since they found the prevalence of celiac in patients presenting with irritable bowel is about 3%. So that's high enough that you get enough yield, higher than in the general population. And so that's what we should be doing as part of our initial evaluation. Henry, what are you going to recommend for us this week?
Well, it's your fault, Mark. You last episode, you sort of chided me for my love of baseball and the Civil War. And so I actually had a book that I started reading. It's only 150 pages, so I finished reading the book. Sometimes we read books to expand our perspectives, give us a whole different way of looking at things and stuff. But sometimes you got to read just for pure joy. So while I might be trying to tackle Sir Thomas More's Utopia coming up, I just read George Kirsch's book called Baseball in Blue and Gray. And it ties my two favorite subjects together. And among other things, it kind of tells us about the evolution of the game, how the rules came about since the 1830s, and how those evolved during the Civil War, including how the two major styles of play, the New York style and the Massachusetts style, gradually merged. So one used a square diamond and the other square field, and the other used the traditional diamond, different numbers of players, whether or not they had foul balls and stuff. So it was during the Civil War when soldiers from different perspectives came in and the rules started to merge. It's a great book if you want to learn a little bit more about this, an easy read as well.
When I was living in Ireland a couple of years ago, I went to Croke Park and watched some hurling match. And hurling is like they running with baseball bats and a baseball and trying to bat it while wearing helmets. Now that's a sport. Much more exciting. Anyway, Kate, thanks so much for joining us. That was great. We'll definitely have you back soon. Who knows? Maybe we'll never have John back.
I'll never be
off
John
in Florida this week, and you know, we'll see. Maybe, but it's been great having you, and thank you so much. And keep doing good work in Chicago. The URL for obtaining CME credit again is iafp.mclms.net. Illinois Academy of Family Physicians is accredited by the ACCME to provide CME for physicians. They designate this podcast for 1/2 AMA Category 1 credit. They adhere to the conflict of interest policy of the ACCME and the AMA. You can read our complete disclosure on the IAFP website. I hope everyone enjoyed today's discussion. We did. Please tell your friends about us. Like us on iTunes, and we'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.